The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
So some of my perspective on what kinds of things you can do with bioaction game mechanics, you kind of like see through that lens.
But it's not the be-all and end-all. I'm basically sharing you my perspective, but it's not the only perspective out there. In particular, I have very little that I feel qualified to say about things like sports. Things where you're talking about athletic competitions, faster, higher, stronger, that sort of thing. But I'm a little bit more engaged in games where there's role-playing, where you're taking on a persona or at least some sort of behavior that you aren't just normally doing in real life. It's not just about how fast you can run or how skilled you are at hitting the ball, that sort of thing. Let's see. And also, not every single live-action game needs to necessarily fit within role-playing or sports. You know, you've got things like party games. This afternoon, we'll have the lead designer for Dance Central coming in to do a little Q&A about Dance Central around 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the TV lounge. You guys are all welcome to do that. And that's arguably a live-action game. Sure, you've got a computer, you've got a one. How much is the Kinect? $150,
something like
$150 piece of equipment connected to a $250 Xbox.
How much cost that?
To a screen that's not even more than that. You've got all this technology, but in the end, what's that game about? You know, what's Rock Band about? It's about the people who are in the living room. You know, and what is one of the arguments that Jesper Riel, in a different chapter in Casual Revolution, he argues that one of the big things that's happened with gaming is this reintroduction of the space in front of the screen. The living room space has come back into play. You haven't lost that with board games or card games, but you know, for electronic games, really it used to be something that existed with arcade games. You know, you've got these giant motorcycles or steering wheels and stuff like that. And you still kind of had it with some really expensive computer games, like flight simulators, with people who buy like joysticks. And I'm a big train fan, so I've got a PlayStation 1 train controller. It's the speed, and it's throttle and brakes. That's all it is. That's steering when it comes to trains. It's a lot of fun. But you know, so with arcade games, and yeah, of course you have things like DDR. There's this whole idea that you're going to be engaging your entire body. And you could argue that those are live action memes. And you take the technology out, and what you've got, this whole idea of this, here's this human body, and you're playing with it, and all its constraints. It's beholden to gravity. It can't move faster than a certain speed. It's kind of ungainly, and it's got roughly a certain size. Gives you constraints that you can work with in terms of game mechanics. One of the things that we did last year was we actually had a live action game assignment in this class, and the constraint was you had to be able to play the game in this room. And was newspaper a constraint?
No,
that was one team's decision to use the newspaper as a constraint. But they did things like blindfold people. You know, like they were playing around with the senses of the body so that you could hear where one person had unlimited ammunition in terms of like little balls of newspaper and a bucket, but couldn't see where everybody else was. And everybody else could move around the room on sheets of newspaper. They had to step on sheets of newspaper. So you could always hear where they were stepping.
And you know, the person with the bucket was trying to help the people who was there, who was stuck on the ground. If you got hit, you had to like go out of the magic circle and then, you know, start coming in. Your whole idea is to be able to tag the person who's actually throwing all of these newspaper balls. They had a little newspaper hat that you could like grab. That's pretty awesome because, you know, what do you need to play that game? You need one set of rules, a chair, a clean recycle bin, specifically with that truck, or was that bin, and a newspaper. You know, but there were all these things implied about what you can do. It's like, well, okay, your target is going to be roughly the size of a human body, and roughly the weight of a human body. It's going to be able to move at roughly the same speed of human body, and you cannot have multiple targets in the same place at once. In fact, it's hilarious when you try, because you know, you get these collisions, and because you're playing with the humans, or with all five of the human senses, usually just sight, hearing, I don't know anyone's made a smell game, but you will have a situation where the people who were standing on the newspapers will try to make noise near the other people who are playing the game, so they will draw attention away from themselves. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it leads to hilarious collisions, a good time to have by one. And those kinds of party games, you know, King of the Hill, any other, can anyone think of any like playground type games that are personal favorites?
Freeze tag.
Lava.
What's
lava? You have like a playground, like, you know, swings and all the things you can climb on, and like you're playing generally on like a rock, like the little pebble, like rocky stuff, and like if you step on the pebble stuff, that's like the lava and you get burnt. And so like you have to stay hanging on like all the metal parts, and then usually there's someone who's like immune to the lava trying to tag you so that like they can walk all over the lava but they can't go on the structure.
So
lava monster.
Did the game ever stop? Just out of curiosity.
Absolutely not.
Well, someone becomes the next lava monster.
Yeah, once you tag, then you switch roles.
Oh, I see.
Keep going.
But the thing is, like, I never played that in like playground. I always played it in like my living room with like couch cushions over the floor and stuff.
Oh, that's
all I ever did.
Cool.
That sounds really dangerous.
Are you sitting on the
bunk bed? You can have wheelie chairs and push off thing. Yeah.
I used to have a bunk bed, so there was like some verticality that I could have in my bedroom and with my two brothers. But they were both bigger than me, so I was last.
Sure. Bunk bed was awesome.
I mean, you can sort of think of, you know, that on one hand these are athletic games because they do test your ability to move and the control that you have in your body, which is why it's so popular among kids who are sort of trying to master what their bodies are capable of. But on the other hand, they're also sort of games of mimicry, going back to the Kalawa definition, because they're sort of pretending that there's lava, and they're sort of pretending that you're a person who cares that there's lava, or a monster that's immune to it. And these games don't necessarily, and there may be some rules about, okay, you've been tagged, now we swap. I've seen games where, sure, I've technically been tagged out of this game, but since this game really has no end state, that just means that, oh, I lost, now I'm back in the game again. It's like playing a Doom deathmatch, you know, and you die, and you're just right back in the game again, right? Let's see. Anyone play those? I think it's like, I can't remember what was the name of the football variant where you just have like a scarf attached to you.
Oh, flag
football. And for those people who, everyone knows what it is? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyone doesn't? Huh?
It's football, but you just have a flag and instead of being tackled.
Yeah, you think rush flag, it's the same.
Instead of tackling, you just grab the flag. And that's an abstraction, right? And that's an abstraction of something that you well could physically do. You could grab this person and pull him to the ground.
Does touch football exist in
a smaller level of abstraction because you can really hit someone pretty damn hard with touch football. But it's an abstraction of, here's this thing that I personally, physically could do, but I'm going to introduce a level of abstraction for, I don't know, safety. That's usually the reason. And so you've got the human body, and you've got all of its values and virtues and all of its curses. You know, you've got issues of safety.
you've got you don't want people to hurt each other, and you can add, but yet human beings and their bodies are extremely capable of hurting each other
with no added implements at all.
Even worse when it gets to a game and there's someone's trying to win something, you know, and if you don't have an explicit rule that says you can't punch this person, but you have a game that is very athletic, someone's going to try. That's why you get these sort of abstractions, and you call it to pretend in that mimicry form, like, all right, I grabbed this thing off you, now you have just been tagged. And now I've effectively tackled you and you can't move anymore. So what I'm trying to draw attention to with these examples is that with live action games, the thing that you have to keep in mind all the time is at what point is the person who's playing actually the character who's playing. It's really, really hard to tell when it comes to live action games. If you're playing in sports, it's the same. It's the same thing. You know, name any given athlete. You know, and their performance in the sport is who they are. It's the same person. If I'm role playing, then the person that I'm playing is not supposed to be the same. But there need to be a whole bunch of rules that basically specify that the character that I'm playing is not actually the person that you're seeing in front of you. You know, Philip Tan, the player, is not the Count of Monte Cristo or something like that.
One interesting exception to that is like wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Like the, not like wrestling, like actual like high school wrestling, but like wrestling that's on TV, like I don't remember what it's called.
Oh yeah.
Because everybody puts on a persona, like they're never the same person that they are. I just thought it was interesting when you said that any sports person, but like that's one exception.
That's true, that creates a lot of discussion about whether wrestling is a sport.
Right,
it's athletic.
Yeah.
Everyone agrees that it's athletic, but so are trapeze artists athletic, but you wouldn't consider that a sport.
Right.
So, in fact, if I understand correctly, wrestlers are insured as circus performers. Because they have the same risks and they're sort of playing the same role as a performance. But you're right, that's one of those things where it's a persona. The really, really good wrestling networks play around with what's real and what's not. You know, yeah, sure, these two people are putting on these ridiculous personalities, you know, threatening to kill each other over the most trivial and made up of circumstances, and crazy accents and costumes and everything. But when they're bleeding, they're actually bleeding. There's no denying on it, and no doubt occasionally they actually get angry at each other, and you know, people actually get hurt. And playing around with that line is actually some of the appeal that you get in things like professional wrestling. I guess that's what the terminology. That they use. Very different from something like mixed martial arts, right? You know, there's no... Is there a person? I don't watch mixed martial arts.
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure it's just
the personality, but they are very associated with the person.
Yeah. So they are the person.
Right.
Yeah. They have stage personalities, but they do have strong personalities.
Right. That's definitely a sport. I mean, they're actually fighting.
Yeah. If you look at Muhammad Ali, for instance, and a half... sure, extremely athletic person, but the personality had a lot to do with it as well, with how successful that he was. You know, the way that he taunted people, on TV and on cameras before the game, so that people would get all worked up for the game, made him a star. Sure, he was athletic, but you know, that's what's part of it. So where that line is, and as designers, you get some control over that through the rules that you're writing. And there are a couple of tactics that you can focus on. But I want to segue into that's a tension. That is one thing that's pulling your design in one direction, which is how am I going to figure out what the difference between the person who's playing this game and the character that they're playing, or the role that they're playing, is going to be. In your games, for this next assignment, you know, if you've got people playing mental patients, then you've got to figure out how you're going to draw that line. You want to be kind of clear whether it's the player who's actually upset at you or the character who's actually upset at you.
But if you draw that line too broadly, then you got this situation where I'm supposed to be angry at you, but I'm laughing all the time because this is a ridiculous situation and emotional. Pretending to be really emotional can usually make a lot of people react by laughing just to release the tension in space. In fact, that happened when Dion was role-playing with Caesar, right? I mean, sure, they were laughing. They were trying to level best to take it as seriously as possible, and everybody else in the room was laughing to relieve that tension. And sometimes that's okay for your game. In fact, sometimes that's great for your game, and sometimes that's detrimental. Depends on what you're going for. But you have to understand that is something that's pulling all your design, why your rule exists, why your game mechanic exists, and why your game mechanic is written in a certain way. That's one of the tensions that's pulling in a certain direction. In reality, that's actually two different tensions, because in one sense, you're trying to make an experience as immersive, as feeling like you're actually doing it as possible. And on the other hand, you don't want to make it so associated with who you are and what you're actually doing that people start to think, oh wow, this player is actually mad at me, or this player could actually hit me at this point, No, the character could hit me, but the player is not going to hit me. So I call that verisimilitude. These are just words that I picked up from dictionary to describe these things. This one, they were in my master's thesis. Verisimilitude is basically the when you're trying to it's a tension when you're designing a game mechanic, and that tension is telling you I want to make this experience as immersive and as true to life as possible. And the opposite of that is what I call dissociation, which is really hard to pronounce, so sometimes I just call it separation. But how do you draw that line between who I am and who my character is? And I'll give you a couple of examples just to get these ideas down. In a live-action role-playing game, actually, who doesn't know what a live-action role-playing game is or doesn't have a good, clear idea?
Not how they work.
Okay. So maybe a little bit of background just so that I can use the examples. Do folks know how a tabletop role-playing game generally works? Like a D&D game?
I really know.
Okay. All right. So start from scratch. Imagine improv theater. Imagine you have an environment where you have a bunch of people who want to enact some sort of scene together. This scene the scene is usually something like 5 minutes, maybe half an hour. In a live-action role-playing game, that's more likely an hour to 10 days to 30 days long, a much longer period of time. But the motivation is the same. We're in this space to enact some sort of shared reality, shared created reality together. Now, in a role-playing game, that's done by the usual additional rules and usually some sort of world setting and some sort of character description. And how these things are told to you could be as simple as the game master walks up to each person and explains what's going on. You are all cats in an alleyway, and some of you are, are hungry and looking for food, some of you are on top of the pecking order and you kind of make sure that you get all the food. Here's how you eat food, here's how you move food around. Go. That sort of thing. A game master could just do it at that level, and you've got a live action role playing game. There's usually some sort of win condition or at least some sort of time limit to tell you when the game's over. When you get a little bit more detail and when you start mixing and matching it with the conventions of other kinds of role playing games, computer and tabletop role playing games, you have things like character sheets, where you're given your information on a piece of paper, or you create your information on a piece of paper. And that information is only available to you and the game master. It's secret information for intents and purposes. And you will use different means to convey chunks of the information to the rest of the world. Like, I'm actually not female, but I'm playing a female character, so maybe I'll wear a badge or something that has my gender on it. And that tells the rest of the world, treat me like a female. That's one example. I may actually be psychic, but the rest of the world can't necessarily see that except for maybe other psychic people. So maybe I'll have a little Greek symbol or something. Not psi, that would be too obvious.
Omega.
or maybe my badge is a different color or something. And people who are not psychic have no idea what that means. And people who are playing other psychic characters now see, oh, that person has a red badge. You know, I am sensing psychic waves. And maybe then now there are game mechanics that I can do with that person. It's like actually all the psychic people know each other's cell phone numbers or something, and we can talk to each other. That's an example.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that would be easy way to mechanic it. So the connection with improv theater is actually stronger than a lot of people may generally assume, because a lot of people think of it live action role playing games, and they focus on the games part of it, you know, and they think of it as an RPG in the computer sense. So you roll your own character in the sense of I have my character's stats, my character's abilities. A lot of these stats and abilities don't necessarily need to be stuff that's written down, because again, you're dealing with a human body. So how strong is your character? I don't know, how strong are you? You know, how long a sword do I have? Well, how long is that piece of foam over there? Like, that's your sword now. You got
When I learned to the Assassin's Guild, I played the character that's supposed to be very, very strong. Mm-hmm. I'm not very, very strong, but I had, as you described, a little badge. The way that it manifested itself in gameplay was that at some point I challenged someone to an arm wrestling duel, mm-hmm. and they made sure they looked at my stat and saw, oh, I know what this means, and so even though they were about twice my size, they pretended to lose.
it was
very entertaining.
So that's the spectrum of, you know, on one hand there are these games where the kinds of games that Jeremy describes allows you to play things that are physically very different from you. And then there are games, there are some live action role playing games.
It's just how strong you are.
Yeah, it's just how strong you are. A lot of those are like buffer LARPs. People will dress up in actual armor that they've decided to make out of leather or duct tape, and you know, they will swing around swords that are foam padded. They'll go out to a forest somewhere in typically New England, and you know, spend three days in the middle of a forest, you know, sleeping in a cabin somewhere and pretending to do fantasy adventuring. And every once in a while, there will be GM control volunteers who will be wearing like monster masks, and you go ahead and fight them. You know, that's one form. That's on the other spectrum. But it's all this. It's a spectrum. You know, it's not like, you know, there's these like the buffalo LARPs where you run around with sticks, and there are Assassin's Guild type LARPs where most of your abilities are governed by numbers and stats. Yeah, it's kind of this spectrum. You can think of the Assassin's Guild type things as being very much inspired by what you could do on a computer, what you could do on tabletop LARP. Because on tabletop LARP, how strong the character is has nothing to do with how strong the player is. Right? You know, it's what stat you wrote for it.
Just recently, I found out that in New England, there are basically LARPs which get done with air rifles.
Mm-hmm.
So
like military almost.
Yeah.
Paintball.
But they're not paintball. So you instead shoot people with plastic pellets. Airsoft is what they're called. Mm-hmm. And so like one team will dress up as U.S. soldiers and the other ones like Middle Eastern insurgents or something in a town.
Wow.
It's elaborate, but it's slightly distasteful. And you can go and look at their website. I think it's the New England Airsoft Association or something like that, and they have like little excerpts that have been videocammed of these.
But the people who are,
and there's like negotiation between the two sides and what have you. They actually pretend to take on the roles of the insurgents or the people. And like sometimes they have. Sometimes they're just shooting each other. Other times they're like trying to find out who in the town is the person who's the bad guy. Mm-hmm.
sometimes it gets more elaborate, and it's like, you know, we're all going to, some of us are actually going to be civilians, and some of us are actually going to be combatants, and you have to figure out who's who. That one will be really, really interesting if they had rules for IEDs, because I think that's something that annoys me about games that involve Middle Eastern combatants, is that they don't have rules for IEDs, and it's like, that's the primary form of combat in that space. Anyway, that's a good point. Military exercises are actually, a lot of them are basically live-action role-playing games. And they're all the way from, I'm actually running around with a gun full of blanks or shooting pellets or shooting a laser beam that is going to register on some other soldier's gear as being hit.
They call them war games.
We call them war games.
Or I miss not to play.
Yeah. And yes, that's the thing. You also have the other end of military simulations where there's just a bunch of people in a room on looking at a screen. A whiteboard with a little map on it, and they're moving forces around, you know, like a tabletop LARP. But those are still considered sort of live action things because every person in the room is representing someone in the chain of command that would normally be in a war room at the time. I'm the commander, you're the lieutenant or something like that, and I'm going to say, give me the status of, you know, Washington DC, has it been nuked yet? That sort of thing. And you know, lieutenant says, you know, we have three missiles coming in or something based on some lookup. The term for that is typically called Kriegsspiel, especially when it's real people playing against real people. Like this, it's two or more player game where not everyone's on the same side. If it's just on one side, then just the war game terminology just tends to be more a catch-all. But when you have two players on each side and they're playing through these things, how results get resolved also can vary. There are obviously digital and mathematical ways to compute. Okay, I have given an order to fire a missile at Singapore, and it's going to take, you know, 2 hours for it to land, and there's a percentage that it might land and things like that. You could do it that way. But traditionally, what's actually been done is that you say, this is what I'm going to do. And someone far more experienced than you, usually your instructor, or one of several instructors, takes that information and goes into another room and talks to the people who are actually doing the same thing with your opposing team. And they're just saying, okay, in this event, what's going to happen? And then they go back to each team and they report, you know, your missile missed, or, you know, your troops engaged, you found your opponent's troops in this location and you lost 50% of your troops, this sort of thing. And that's kind of the traditional Kriegsspiel. The nice thing about that is that takes advantage of the fact that not just the players, but everybody is a live-action human being. Because you have flexibility, you know, you can do ridiculous things, like, you know, that programmers or game designers may not necessarily have assumed were possible, but happen to make sense in the heat of that particular game. And you have real people deciding, this is what's going to happen, so we'll make up a logical solution. In military, that's why you want people who are really, really experienced. In a non-military live-action role-playing game, like the kind that gets played around in MIT, people will still do that. You know, I'm in a game where, I don't know, it's a steampunk setting, and I don't have all the equipment I need to build this machine of death that I'm supposed to be completing, but I could take apart some of the other machines that are in the world, and then the game master says, wait a minute, we forgot to put rules about that. Or we never thought about anyone taking apart other people's equipment, but it makes perfect sense in this world. So, okay, it's going to take you 2 hours and you have to be in this room, but after that, you can pull the parts of me, you know. And that's one of the other side of live-action role-playing is that often the people who are controlling the game are also live-action. They're also there, and they can improvise along with the players. So you have that bit of flexibility. You're limited by how experienced those people are.
people who don't tend to be terribly experienced tend to make rash decisions that end up hurting the playability of the game. Sometimes they get lucky, sometimes they don't. Let me see. One example in early on when I was making live action role playing games was I had a game mechanic where if anybody, if one of the police officers in this sort of detective scenario wanted to do a background check, they could ask the game master, and some amount of time, actually it was fairly instant because it's a fairly modern kind of a system, and the assumption was that they find a computer and they will look it up and I will give them information. And that led to two problems, was that, first of all, what happens if I'm not physically in the same location as the person who wants the information? And this is weird to think of a computer with legs walking around all by itself. It's not a science fiction game. And on the other hand, it means that I needed to have all the information about everybody at my fingertips at all times, which often was not true. So someone will come in, I need any information about this character, you know, I'm performing the lookup, and it's like, I'll get back to you in 2 hours because I do not have that information with me. I'm going to look it up and I'll give it to you later. Now I don't make that mistake anymore, but that was the kind of mistake that I used to make when I was a early GM, because I hadn't really thought about what that would require from me as a game master. Now that's a different tension. I am actually going to take a chunk of this to sort of fill out the tensions while I'm discussing them. I talked about verisimilitude. I talked about dissociation or separation. And what I'm talking about with that mistake that I made is just plain old feasibility. Something that you probably have already run into with the games that you've designed, but you know, in many of the games that you design, feasibility could be thought of as just plain old scope. You know, it's like, how big is this game? How long is it going to take us to put all these bits together? I'm looking at you, Jeremy. Can we order these bits in time, and are they going to be delivered in time for the class? I know multiple teams had this problem. Yeah.
They run.
Yeah. One thing that the okay, so here's, let me see what I can combine some of these ideas together. One thing that the Assassin's Guild likes to have are people who kind of have locked memories. You know, they know something, but they don't know that they know it.
Little memory packets.
Yes, little memory packets, little pieces of paper that they printed out and folded up and stapled. You know, takes you about 20 seconds to make one of those. Now imagine a game that has maybe 60 people, and each person maybe has 5 locked memories because the GMs really love this idea. And how long is it? 5 times 60, 300.
That's 27.
It's only about an hour.
It's only about an hour. Does it ever actually only take an hour to actually produce that? You get like staple cuts and paper cuts.
You have to write them all.
You have to write them all.
So it's like 2 hours.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a little less than 2 hours, actually.
It's a little, yeah. But
no way.
By the end of
the
it...
20 seconds?
Yeah.
6 minutes.
Yeah,
it's not 20 seconds.
It,
20 times 3.
And then what happens is that, oh wow, we have 300 pieces of paper, all of which are now folded and almost indistinguishable from each other, and we've got to figure out who gets which.
Oh, right, right, right.
and these are the concerns. You know, it's like when you know that's a feasibility issue. It's like doing something like that for one or two players is extremely feasible. It takes almost no time from the game master's point of view. Doing like that for your entire player base, if you have a 60-person game, on a large scale, you know, becomes the majority of your prep time. You know, so suddenly you're setting aside a whole day just to deal with that, and your game's only like 3 days long or something like that. You know, exactly what that level of effort. Things to preserve the game master's sanity. You know, the MIT janitorial staff, the facility staff, are pretty ruthless when it comes to picking up stuff that has fallen on the floor. So say that's a really important piece of paper that you've taped up on the wall somewhere here in MIT. This information, this is the place that your players are looking for. They've combed all of campus and they need to find this location. And that tape that you used just wasn't that strong. It fell on the piece of it and janitorial staff just vacuums it up, throws it away. Now what happens to your game? You know, can your game even end? Are you going to just have a whole bunch of really tired, pissed players on your, chasing you down as a game master? That the way how you resolve this can be built into your game mechanics. You can build things like multiple redundancy. You know, like in addition to a sign, there will usually be this other thing in that same area. If you find one and don't find the other, it means something has dropped off. You know, inform the game master, and the game master will go and fix it at some point in time in the future. You could give people, if you have a game that has no secret locations and you're making it, campus-wide, you could just give people a map of all the information. Sure, you still want stuff on the wall because, you know, it's kind of neat to be able to walk into a classroom like this and say, oh, mortuary, that's where I am. And then you're suddenly reminded, okay, maybe I should be role-playing for the fact that I'm on the wall, that sort of thing. Instead of like walking through a space and you had a map that told you that you were in a mortuary, but you weren't looking in your map, so you just walked through the space and treated it like a classroom. Like, yes, I am going to do my tooling in this room. It's a morgue. What are you doing in a morgue? So it's really neat to be able to have those things to give players information about what's going on in the space and to help them make believe, help them imagine what they could possibly do in the space, maybe even give them clues about what they need to be doing in order to advance their goals. But then you also want to be able to have backup plans for when those things fail. That's part of feasibility. You know, you don't want your game to break halfway just because janitorial staff came through, or the glue, the wind blew or something, and now your game's up. So that's another tension, information. And that's not entirely unlike the information that we've discussed in this class back earlier this semester. But with live-action games, especially live-action games that don't have any kind of turn-based thing, they're happening in real time, you're moving in real time, information overload on the player becomes something that you have to be very careful when you're designing a game mechanic. How much is someone expected to know at any given time? This is going to be very applicable for any of the games that you design for the third assignment. If you decide to do a live-action game, you think about, here's somebody who's moving around in a space, maybe it's a hospital or maybe it's a doctor's office. And this person is trying to remember some number of statistics, about their character, how agitated I am, how what's my current a number that determines how many drugs I've got in me right now, that sort of thing. That you've got these stats, and once you get too high, then what happens is that you've got a character standing there, trying to do all the math in their head and not role playing. If they're role playing anything, they're role playing like a mathematician or a deer in headlights. You're losing that immersion, you're losing the verisimilitude of the, I'm supposed to be an angry person, but I'm standing here trying to do math about how angry I am. And you've got that tension of information and verisimilitude. There are times where you actually kind of want that, though. There are ways to take that to turn that into to your advantage. In particular, when the thing that you want people to be doing, the kind of activity you want them to engage in, are the things that players will generally be uncomfortable doing with each other. Physical violence would be a good example of that. I want to be able to hurt this other character, but I don't want to hurt this other player. So what are the things that I can do to bridge that gap?
Insult is another.
verbally, sure, there are ways to do that, but you might need rules or at least some guidance from the GM to say, take that seriously, you know, because that can very easily drift into the realm of, yeah, that's just a joke, you know. Rock, paper, scissors, you know, it's like that could be a mechanic for a fist fight, for instance, you know, or just a fist. Did you succeed in avoiding that?
Nerf guns,
things that
games
shoot little pieces of plastic, dice,
like odds or evens or something.
Odds and evens, yeah. Okay.
Health tokens, like inside football.
Say what?
Health tokens, like inside football.
Give me some more detail.
I mean, like in if someone has like a certain number of like flags, and so you hurt them by taking one.
Oh, I see. So like you might have like multiple flags, for instance.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's an idea. It's like a health bar. Okay.
So CR ratings, dice rolling, and buffers.
Yeah, so dice rolling is sort of the general term of like things, randomizing numbers. In fact, rock paper scissors is kind of randomizing thing almost. And then you have like toy weapons, right? You know, probably not so relevant for the yin violence, but you could imagine setting up a room full of foam things, and which you will be quite happy to throw at each other. You know that this cylinder of foam of pipe insulating material is not going to hurt anyone when you throw that, which makes it more likely that I'm going to pick it up and throw it at someone. You know, it's like clearly it's something that was designed for me to throw, that the GM's put there. And if you want your players to be engaging in that kind of activity, that is technically, you could have put a real bottle there, you could have put a real mug or a computer or something in there. There's no reason why you as a GM couldn't, but they are deliberately deciding to put something fake there to clue the player into maybe there is something I can do with that I wouldn't necessarily want to do if it was a real thing. I wouldn't want to throw a real bottle at somebody, but I would easily throw a full bottle at somebody. Same thing for Nerf guns, dart guns, disc guns, you know, it's like you put this something with a trigger in somebody's hands that's going to launch a little cheap piece of plastic at someone, they're itching for a chance to use it, really. let's see. What else? Dice are difficult. The problem with dice is you kind of need a flat surface to roll it on, and you might not have that.
Much more frequently see people do card drawing, so you'll have
a deck of cards. Still a little bit risky. You could end up going all over the floor.
The only thing that I've seen people do is some kind of resource management style thing, where essentially you have like instead of like might cards or something, you might have three of them. You can win a challenge by giving one to the other player that you're mm-hmm. fighting with.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of when you run out of them, you can't like overpower people anymore. So,
so it's like the amount of energy I've got.
Yeah, it's like the amount of energy you've got.
Yep.
And also, if you discard them or give them to another player, then it's kind of the difference between, I mean, these things are just gone and they kind of circulate around.
Right, so there's a limited amount of resource.
Yeah. So if there's the circulation thing, then you can get whooped a few times, but after being whooped, then suddenly you get a chance to whoop back.
Well, that one's interesting. This is the fifth one that I want to talk about, which is just competition. You know, a term that you guys are already very familiar with. But you know, at what point do your game mechanics? Are you designing your game mechanics not necessarily to enhance the realism or to encourage certain behaviors or to give the player enough information about what they're allowed to do or what they should be doing? And you're just going into the realm of how do I make this competitively interesting? Real fights, if you've taken a bunch of blows, you do not get stronger. But from a game point of view, well, if you're Bruce Banner, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, but from a competitive point of view, or at least from a traditional gameplay point of view, that sounds like a great idea. You know, it gets you back into the game, whereas any very realistic fight mechanic is really probably going to be a positive feedback mechanic. You win, you keep winning. So you can think of these five different things as, you know, not it's not like game balance, but these are decisions that you have to make either as an individual designer or as a team about what any given mechanic in your game is trying to accomplish. It's rarely mutually exclusive. It's usually trying to hit multiple one of these things. You don't want to fall down on any of these things, especially not feasibility. You know, it's like, yes, this is the perfect game mechanic. If we had 2 years to be able to put together this, all the things that we had. And there are games that have failed to run because of that idea. Especially live-action games that have a heavy computer component. Especially if they're designed by MIT students, rapidly designed into a software engineering project that never finishes. And the game kind of disappears, and it's all about this damn website that will have solved everything else. You know, it's completely realistic because it's a hacking mechanic that actually happens on a computer, and the skills scale to your ability as a character, which a computer already knows, and you don't have to remember, because so you can feel really lead. And it's competitive because it's like, you know what your opponents are doing, but not everything that they're doing. And it's going to take us 5 years to write this code. The game's never going to happen. So let's see. Let me think of other examples just to sort of put some ideas in your head. Back to the idea of things that you might be, that players might be uncomfortable doing with each other. Seduction is one of those things that's, if you don't have a game mechanic for it, it never happens in the way that you want it to. And that helps the game. You know, if it happens, it's happening between the players, and that causes all kinds of problems. So if you come up with a rule, come up with a game mechanic that feels nothing like real life seduction. We're going to play a game of blackjack now. If we win, you're now in love with me. You know, it's like, that's not how seduction actually works. But it actually makes it easier for players to say, I can do that. I can play a game of blackjack. There's no social awkwardness in playing a game of blackjack.
I mean, you can associate that with like, I win this game, so I slipped inside your glass a love potion. So now you're in love with me.
Yeah, and
something like that.
Yeah, I mean that's. But you see, in that particular case, you're describing an action that people might be more actually willing to do through some sort of simple mechanic, like, okay, instead of love potion, we're going to mechanic that with maple syrup or something. You know, we're going to actually give you a vial. And if you drink something in a game that tastes like maple syrup, talk to a GM, because you probably just drank some magic potion. But if the goal is, all right, you're playing in a film noir game, and you're supposed to be engaging in constant witty banter, laden in sexual innuendo. A lot of people have a lot of difficulty with that. Sometimes it works. I've made it work in some games, but it makes it a lot easier if the success or failure in that is not going to be bottlenecked by whether the players feel comfortable doing it. You know? So creating a game mechanic that actually feels a little bit less than what activity you're trying to represent may make it easier for people to engage in. Activity. Same thing goes in combat. Playing rock, paper, scissors feels nothing like an actual fight. But people will be much more willing to play rock, paper, scissors with each other than to punch each other. So, you know, come up with that rule, you know, give them a little plastic gun, give them something to make it easier, and they'll be willing to engage in an activity more often. Violence, you know, will probably be the thing that comes up a lot in the next segment. So, let me see what else we can get into. It's about 2:00. How many of folks here have played some variant of Mafia or Werewolf? Who's played Mafia in particular? Okay. Yeah. Who's played Werewolf? Okay. So those are live-action games, too. And those are live-action games that specifically don't try to draw too sharp a division between who you are and who your player is. Mm-hmm. You're given a role that's, you know, that's a card that basically says whether you're mafia or whether you're a villager, I think.
Civilian.
Right. And the whole idea is that everybody who's that's a character sheet that tells you, that gives you private secret information about the role that you're supposed to play. But that's, in my opinion, these particular games, and we're going to play some variants of them, they are what you are told by the cards is only what you're allowed to do. What actually gives you the role is what you decide to do. It's like, I'm playing Mafia, and I'm going to say, Patrick is black. You know, and other people in the room agree with me, and you know, Patrick's character gets taken out of the game. That decision is the decision that actually made me Mafia, and that decision is the decision that other people are trying to catch, because that's why you know they're trying to find a person who's actually responsible for various acts when everybody's eyes are closed. The general model for these games is, you know, there are cycles. For Werewolf is a day and night cycle, and I think for Mafia it's also day and night. But the idea is that during the night, everybody who's not Mafia gets to have their eyes open. Everybody who's not Mafia keeps their eyes closed. Everybody who is Mafia keeps their eyes open. And people who are Mafia can communicate through some GM-mediated, some Game Master-mediated way to specify a player to be taken out of the game. It's usually a point.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen things with blinks. Because as the GM moves around, sometimes that gives you clues, because you can hear, even with your eyes closed, you can hear where the GM is. And then that's like the night cycle. And then during the day cycle, everyone opens their eyes, and whoever's been taken out of the game, you know, is informed, you are now
on
the
story,
and everyone knows, and then everyone starts discussing and accusing each other of being responsible for it. And the whole point of the game is for the villagers to identify who all the Mafia is before everyone in the village dies. You know, it's a live action game that doesn't have a lot of action, I would say. You know, there's one action, which is closing your eyes, opening your eyes, and it's pointing. There are variants where sometimes there is a...
This Godfather. I've seen websites with a whole list of different roles that are just ridiculous. Like this gravekeeper, it's a necromancer or something.
Yeah, it's like people who can bring characters back from the dead. There are people who can basically do a background check, you know, angels,
cops.
I've heard of angels and cops, yeah, who have, you know, and then you go from two cycles to three cycles per round, you know, four cycles per round, where different people have eyes open, and you get different bits of information about what the world state is like. You know, the fact that killing somebody is pointing at them, you know, that's a dissociation mechanic, right? It's not like you're actually being asked to engage in physical combat with them, even though the fiction of the game is that you're assassinating this person in the middle of the night. The verisimilitude, I would imagine, and competition largely comes down in the discussion phase. You know, you're trying to put players in an environment where you've got a paranoid group of villagers, a paranoid town, and they're all mutually accusing each other, and both the act of trying to not be accused and trying to deduce who is the right person to accuse is a compelling competitive experience. That's what all these games are really about. So all the emphasis is all the time of the game, frankly, is devoted to that phase of when everyone sits down and discusses with each other who could be the Mafia in this environment. You want to walk us through one of the variants, maybe?
Yeah. Do you want to like actually play it or just describe it?
We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. We could have two groups or one big group. One big group will
take
the rest.
Yeah, it'll take a while.
Let's do two groups, but how many different rule variants?
I only found one that I thought was really interesting, although we can certainly, like, even the Wikipedia page has a million variants.
I mean, the one I normally would play would be the one where there's mafia and there's cops. Right. Maybe there might be a medic, but...
Inspector, angel, and prostitute.
Oh, I was
that's what I was saying.
What's prostitute do again? If you sleep with the mafia, they don't kill anybody. If you sleep with an inspector... They get incorrect information. If you sleep with a nurse, they don't heal.
I think that's an interesting prostitute rule set I've heard so far.
This is why it's very important to make sure you know what rule set you're playing with before the game starts.
Yeah.
So walk us through the rules, and then what we'll do is we'll break this into two groups, and we'll have two groups play separately. And that's probably the end of the... class activity.
I had found a variant today called Thing, which is based on the John Carpenter movie, which it seems interesting because it takes out one of the roles. The idea is one person is the shape-shifting thing, and at night they infect someone else, and that person becomes a thing as well. So they're not knocked out outright. And then during the day, the group votes and decides on one person to test, and if they test a thing, that person is killed, and they get to test another one.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the idea is that things are trying to outnumber people. Which to me sounds interesting because it takes away that kind of inspector role.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Do you know who gets thing in the middle of the night? Or like does
so I was thinking about this, and what you would need is like for the person who's the thing to kind of indicate to the moderator, and then maybe the moderator could tap them or something and just indicate.
Okay, so if you're a thing, you know you're a thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the things are spreading as opposed to just.
But then if there's two things, do they both agree on another?
Presumably. So this is really interesting because apparently it's played at like this conference for science fiction writers. So there's little snippets of it on the web about the rules from like different blogs and stuff, and it sounds interesting. But of course, the problem is how do you Google for mafia thing.
So
it sounds interesting to me, and then it seems like there's
probably the thing mafia variant.
Try and like, trust me, I spent a while.
So it might be fun actually to have two groups figure out how to play that game just from the description that you've just given. I mean, I think if we split this fast into two, there's going to be enough people who play traditional mafia to know how that works. Mm-hmm. And then we'll just reconvene at the end of it to see what each version people came up with, what were the similarities and what were the differences. Again, that's the flexibility of doing a live-action game when the people who are actually coming up with the rules are actually in the room, the same room as the players, or the players themselves. You get to make stuff up on the fly as long as everyone agrees. So let's give it a shot. While Jason is sorting out the cards, any questions about the stuff that we've been discussing? Yeah.
So the two biggest challenges that I come across in coming up with like group lock mechanics have to do with social challenges and like intellectual skill.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go with intellectual. So it's easy to play a character that's stupider than you. It's really hard to play a character that's smarter than you. And in particular, it's really hard to play a character that's smarter than you if you don't have a GM around all the time to tell you.
You don't know
stuff.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if you have any ideas about how to deal with that. No, the other one is arbitrating social conflicts. Like this is hard in any role playing game.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels like if you want to be able to persuade a character or something, you just want to persuade them because you're role playing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're supposed to be playing a character who is more persuasive than you. But it feels really cheap.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you can just sort of...
You believe me now.
You believe in cards. This also ties in with another issue which frequently pops up in LARPs and role-playing games in general, which is like use of metagame knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So frequently, if you've been persuaded to do something, then you come across players who know, using their metagame knowledge, that they don't want to do the thing that they've been mechanically forced to do.
And they're still
and they're trying to find loopholes constantly. I don't know if you can really force people to abandon their metagame knowledge mechanically,
I have some examples on how the Assassin's Guild in particular has dealt with that. And in some ways it's cheating because they decide in some when I'm going to try to do some of those things. In particular, let's take persuasion for one of those things. The problem with persuasion is that whatever mechanic you come to use other than what you see is what you get. You know, it's like, well, if you manage to persuade someone to do it, then now they're persuaded. Any other mechanic that you come up with runs that risk of the, wait a minute, this is not what I really want to do. So the Assassin's Guild has replaced that with brainwashing, which is the whole idea of you are not being persuaded, you are being forcibly, your goals are being forcibly changed. But now you have other goals. And that's the big difference. You now have, your old goals are no longer your win conditions. Your new goals are now your win conditions, and you can still win the game by obeying your new goals. So,
that's cool.
Yeah, that's the brainwashing mechanics.
Right. It kind of aligns the interests of the player with the interests of the character.
Yeah, it's like you want to go with your new goals now because how this came up typically in the Assassin's Guild. The Assassin's Guild actually grew out from Circle of Death games, which is kind of like getting to know you. I've got the name of somebody and I need to shoot them with this water gun. Who's this person again? I don't know. I'm a freshman. I haven't met everyone on campus, so I'm going to figure out who this person is. That's where those games came from. The Assassin's Guild kind of grew up from that. Then they became teams. And brainwashing was basically the set of game mechanics that were used for recruiting people in your team. You know, it's like, all right, everyone's got one target, but there are a few people out there whose job is destroy everybody on this opposing faction. But it's only one person in that opposing faction right now. It's only one of me. But I have this brainwashing mechanic that recruits more and more people. So what you thought was I'm just against another individual, becomes my group is against that group. It feels pretty awesome, actually, because what it actually feels, it's a weird game mechanic way of making your character have some sort of development in the game. Because if you think about a role-playing game, character development means your goals now change somehow. But it's really, really difficult for players to give players a means of doing that themselves. Brainwashing was one of the few ways that seems to actually have worked. I'm actively going to knock out this character, put this blicky helmet on them for 5 seconds, and if nobody catches me in this process, I give them new goals. And the person who's reading it is that, dude, this is way more exciting than anything I was doing earlier. You know? You also avoid the metagame problem of loyalty, right? It's like, yeah, I've got this information from this other group, but I've been brainwashed and I don't want to tell you. It's like, no, if you want to tell me now, because it's actually going to help you win. But metagaming in live-action role-playing games, all kinds of live-action games, is a big thing. It's that you know things about the player that, or you know things about the game that you're not really supposed to know. You know, if a person is supposed to be able to teleport from one end of campus to the other end of campus, the character may be able to do that, but the damn player is going to walk all the way in between. And if you happen to run a player halfway, it's like, I now know that player is probably on this side of campus, even though your character really had no idea on how to deal with that. That's just one of those, like, there are game mechanics designed, there are ways to design game mechanics to sort of avoid those situations, but in many, many cases, live action role playing, there is a honor system that really has to kick in. The nice thing about it is that if everyone decides to go by the honor system and agrees that this honor system is necessary for the world to be reinforced, it actually helps reinforce that mutual illusion that this world is real. You know, by saying, I know that I'm not supposed to know this thing, but I am going to play this game as hard as I can in a way that does not take advantage of that information, actually reinforces the world for everybody else. It's the same thing for improv theater. You know, it's like, anyone here involved in improv theater or improv comedy? Yeah. Roadkill? Yeah. So, you know, yes and? The,
for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, what's the basic concept behind that?
Yes and is an idea where if you give someone an offer, they'll take your offer. So if I say, man, we're all out of tomatoes, someone will say,
yes, and the big tomato cook-off is tomorrow, or something like this.
You cannot contradict what was said.
Yeah, not only do you not contradict, you always add information. Every line, at least in the beginning of the scene, should be adding information to the scene. And then after a few lines, you have a very, very elaborate setup that's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. But mutually shared.
Exactly.
So in that same situation of like metagaming is one of those things that's actively working to destroy the reality of your world, and as if all your players agree to try the damn hardest to not let it interfere with the world, it actually strengthens the illusion in a way that it strengthens the scene for improv theater. Hold on, just one thing. There was the other concern that you had before the persuasion issue, which was
characters who, in particular, this comes up a lot in the superhero type situations, what have you, where you have somebody who's either a super genius or
someone who's better than you,
abilities
something
that are just much better than you, and like how would a new mechanic that?
This is a really common trope. The best way that you can do that is to cast the right person. But what I've generally found is that old role-playing game chestnut of separating intelligence from wisdom makes it a little bit easier. You know, there's intelligence, which is your ability to think on the feet, and there's wisdom, which is how much you know about the world. And if you as a game master designing a game can figure out when I say someone's really smart, what do I mean, intelligence or wisdom? It helps you a little bit on thinking how I can use game mechanics or game writing to fix that problem. So if it's intelligence, it's just like, I have the ability to do stuff that other people can't do because I am so smart. And you can literally just give them abilities to act on things in that other people do not have, that people just don't have. I am able to build a telephone out of this coconut because I'm the freaking professor from Gilligan's Island. You know,
I'm a guy.
Like smart. You know, it's like that doesn't mean that I have to act terribly smart. But I'm capable of doing things that other people can't because I've been told specifically I have these abilities. But that's like the intelligence side of things. The wisdom side of things is a little bit harder, which is basically you dump a whole bunch of information on somebody, and you hope that they are capable of making the associations between what's happening in game and what they read. That's a lot harder. It is a problem, but I find that by separating those two, it makes it a slightly easier problem. Patrick?
Yes, this is a bit of a nervous question. Are LARPs usually played in real time?
Typically. They have rules about when to hit the pause button. Basically, in MIT, those are usually enacted when safety becomes an issue. People are running too fast. Somebody just fell down, and you want to be able to stop everyone from running, you know, and so they shout halt. But typically, they're happening in real time because it's really hard to do turn-based stuff that doesn't quickly feel like a board game.
I mean, like when you say someone would want to do like a background check, you say, "I don't know, come back in 2 hours," but you literally like 2 hours.
So yeah, it's like often that literally means just 2 hours, and that's an interesting thing of it's real time, but it's kind of a time delay at the same time. So you as a game master, you can build in game mechanics that take advantage of real time delays to be able to give you as a game master some time to breathe. Typically, they're happening in real time. I wrote a game where the clock stopped somewhere between midnight and 8 a.m. Like the game world literally froze. Well, not literally, figuratively froze at 12 a.m. and 1 minute after 8, the clock will practically, in game terms, have moved one minute, even though there were 8 intervening hours in between, so that people could go and take a break. So, which will be great for like an Army of Darkness type of scenario, right? Because those three people, I don't know how familiar people are with the Army of Darkness series, but those three films are supposed to all happen like within 48 hours. So, Andrew, and Andrew's moving across.
So I guess two quick things. One is, in terms of wisdom, could you possibly have little note cards that are flipped over everywhere, and then the wisdom person, or person with high wisdom, could read about like information in them there?
you could. You could certainly have, you know, take advantage of, you know, if you have a piece of paper taped up on the wall, just put it on the back, right? You know, it's like some people are given the ability to read the back of the paper, some people aren't, which will be a little bit easier than trying to keep it all in your head at once. You can also get very limited wisdom, like the whole, like the psychic example, right? You know, I am sensitive in some way. I can tell when certain things are cursed by giving them clues on printed pieces of paper that nobody else knows how to interpret. You know, like I see this. There is a number associated with each one of these rooms. If that number happens to be even, this is not a place that any sane person would want to be. You know, and there are people who have the wisdom to tell that, and there are some people who don't. You know. So that's another way that you can put little environmental clues. In MIT, the sort of like hiding clues in plain sight, and every single way that you can possibly do that is really exploited. So the numbers, for instance, I've seen games where everyone has like 5 digits on their badge, and every single one of those digits means something. If you happen to be you happen to have the ability to interpret that, but each one of those digits means something different. So that's an example.
And just really quickly, in terms of space, how much space do like Assassin's Guild games?
MIT Assassin's Guild has the advantage of the MIT campus, so it can go anywhere from main campus, you know, bounded by Mass Ave and Ames Street, to all of freaking campus. But players hate that. Players hate walking all the way across campus. It kills their feet. So often it just turns out to be the few rooms that they could get room reservations for in MIT Campus Activities Complex and the sort of general vicinity around there. Outdoors is really not used much because MIT Assassin's Guild loves shooting little plastic things at each other, and with the wind blows, that just sucks. Jeremy?
Can you tell us a story or anecdotes of games that have like gone really horribly slash fallen apart slash?
Oh, absolutely.
And just
how much time have we got?
And then what does it really highlight, like what are the like mistakes that made everyone who's doing these, especially at MIT, they're all smart people and they're written by smart people. So what kinds of mistakes do smart people still make that result in these games like falling apart?
Well,
or bad things.
The most common thing that happens is not even an issue of how smart the game writers were, but how much experience they've had in seeing things go horribly wrong. And
which is why I'm asking.
Just as this class, you know, has given you experience making games, you've seen how some projects can go wrong. A lot of it is just system dynamics, right? You know, it's like I put together a bunch of rules and I did not expect those rules to interact in that way. But because a live action game is difficult to run multiple times, the first time you see it,
how do you play this for a live action game that lasts 2 months?
That actually came up in the forums, I believe. Somebody was asking about this. You can at best play test
given mechanics.
You can play test certain game mechanics. You write down a stripped down version which takes out all of the plot motivations and just test the combat. This is our combat play test. I did that for a Matrix game once. You know, it's like I'm writing a game about a Matrix. Combat is really freaking important. So I just made an entire game where all it was you want to go in and get this thing and then get out. That's the whole rule. And here's your 3 pages of combat. So people are like, holy shit, this is a lot of memory. And that showed me the problems that I had. Unfortunately, it's not one of those. It wasn't so catastrophic that I would use it as a catastrophic game example. So
tell us about catastrophic.
Catastrophic game examples. Okay. I think
it's like someone tripped and hurt themselves. That's sort of not.
No. That's not what you're looking for. I understand. It was a game where everyone was playing undead. I can't remember if they were vampires. I think they were vampires. So they could get knocked down if they got shot, and they will get up again in 5 minutes because they were immortal. Unless they got staked or something, they will get up again. Unfortunately, there were a lot of vampires in game. Many of them were on different factions, so they were going after each other with guns. So when two people who are obviously against each other, shot each other, fell over. They will get up in 5 minutes and shoot each other again. Repeatedly begging for someone to show up and do something to break this deadlock. And that's one of those things where it's like, game mechanically, you know what's supposed to happen, but it sucks, you know, and then was it really right? So like, that's one example.
We have to wait 5 minutes. Can we just continue like shooting?
But the issue is, again, these games are happening in real time. So the 5 minute rule is there possibly for a reason. You know, while you are down for 5 minutes, those 5 minutes may become very valuable for someone who wants you down for those 5 minutes. So, you know, you can kill me, I can kill you, but both of us can knock each other down for 5 minutes. That's a great delaying tactic if I can send one of my friends and can do something that I don't want you interfering with. And if that's the case, then that's great, but often it was just like, oh crap, there's just no way to break the deadlock.
You'd figure the limiting factor, the ammunition, though.
I think that game actually let you pick up your ammunition while you were down. because it can be a really annoying limitation to run out of ammunition, especially if you're playing with the little rubber dart guns. Because carrying a whole pile of them is really annoying. So if the rule is I get to pick them up, then you have the illusion of having a lot of ammunition without having to carry a lot of ammunition. So that's one example of a catastrophic failure. That's a really funny quote regarding brainwashing, actually, which is, you know, where were you? I was not being brainwashed. Who were you with? Not with the people who are brainwashed. This is exactly the problem with the persuasion thing, right? You know, it's like, you know, I want to tell you something because my goals haven't changed far enough to want to align me to my new goals. So I'm going to do everything that I can without breaking the rules. I'm not allowed to tell you that I was being brainwashed. Right? So I can say that I wasn't being brainwashed. Other catastrophic. How long does the game of the thing take, probably?
I don't know.
Okay.
Probably about as long as the game of the
thing. Okay. It was like half an hour?
Yeah.
Depends on the take point.
Well, if you put a time limit on, like, discussions, then...
Discussions,
because I played in the past where it was last hours, just because there was no cap and people just went to these long discussions in between rounds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you put a cap, like, okay, it's going to be this long discussion, and then we're going to kill someone off or something. Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I have one.
Have you ever played online Mafia? It's a totally different experience.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Is that chat involved or something?
On forums, usually. So, basically, when you can look at the history of what people have said and who they've accused and what order they did it in, we change how Mafia pans out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because all of a sudden, people start going, move back and look at the history and compiling statistics of who was first who and who said what and then who must be on their side if that's the case. But then there's this kind of meta knowledge that you can use of this if you're a mafia. Because you can kind of tell if you're mafia. So in our particular case with forums, we were able to kind of communicate as the mafia privately.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant we could, for instance, do things like making sure that we were never the first people to accuse anyone.
Mm.
So as a mafia, you should never do that. Because it immediately makes you look suspicious. Mm. Later on, if somebody turns out to be or not be the mafia.
Right.
So like, there's no way that you can if you're the first person who accuses. But bandwagoning somebody who's not in the mafia is always great. So you can kind of coordinate to do this sort of thing and then, like, try to defeat the statistical analysis that somebody else is doing.
You've got this whole shadow governance feeling.
Also, a great tactic to get you away from being on a team with someone else is to actually accuse someone on your team and hope that they don't actually like vote them off. I've definitely been in a game where we purposely killed off one of the people on our team just so that we wouldn't be accused. This is like, oh, he cannot be on Mafia because he killed off a Mafia. Okay, and then we end up winning because no one figured that out.
I mean, that's one of the best things about all kinds of live action games is that it almost encourages people to look for these kind of
slightly out of the box illusion. These sort of emergent, I'm not really going to expect that, but still fits within the rules because you're dealing with real people for the most part. You're not limited to the cards that you're allowed to play or the turns that you're allowed to take. So taking advantage of that. I have one more disaster story.
I want to hear.
There is. I'll limit it to just one for the people who don't. This is a game where there is a virus that was spreading. People who are in the Assassin's Guild might have already heard of this one, but the whole basic idea is that there was a explosive nanovirus. People who got infected after a certain amount of time will explode, and anybody in the room with them will now be infected. Of course, this was a game, you know, this is kind of a game set in a science fiction kind of thing, and they've got doctors who are capable, who have mechanics to be able to research cures. However, when the doctor happens to be one of the first people to die in the game, what rapidly happens is that what should have been a one-night game turned out to be a one-hour game when everybody exploded. So, you know, I guess that might come down to feasibility, but you can think about it as a, you need a certain amount of redundancy when you're designing any game, but particularly live-action games, because shit happens. And you've got to expect that to happen. There's always this fear about, oh, they put in too many resources into this game and the players are going to find it too easy. And it's more often than not, yeah, there are some players that are going to say, we breeze through that. But rarely do people get terribly upset in a live action game when something is slightly too easy. They get really upset when it becomes when it seems near impossible. You know, it's like, oh, so the GMs only made it possible for one person to fix this problem, and that person, and they didn't think about that person just dying in the beginning of it. So yeah, that was another example. Nine of which were my games. I'm sorry, I feel really bad about not bringing out examples for my games, but I don't know which ones were the ones that I'm generally. Oh, I do have one more. So this was after The Sims came out. And people should already be worried about that. I thought having a bladder spat would be a really good idea for a game. This was a game that was set on a train. This was a game that was set in a train. It was steampunk, so tea was a game. Tea was in fact a combat drug. If you drank tea, your combat stats will increase, but so would your bladder spat. And once your bladder stat was past a certain point, all your combat stats went down and you really had to go to the restroom. Which was really interesting. Most people just reviled that game mechanic because it was one more number they had to hit hold in their head that was stupid annoying and really didn't do terribly much for the immersion of the game. You know, I was thinking, oh, it's a game about traveling on a train, so you use the restroom all the time. That's the only thing I do when I'm traveling. I use the restroom. Most momentous event. Even that led to some interesting emergent situations, because when this train gets attacked and everybody needs to find a safe place to hide, what they all do is they head into the washroom, barricade it, and drink tea until all the combat stats go up the roof, and then win the fight. Because they were right there in the restroom, they could afford to do that. It was hilarious.
This kind of thing people come up with. Yeah. Exploits and...
Yeah.
That's fine.
They may hate the rules, but once they understand how the systems work, they're going to come up with ways to use it to their advantage. And that can be some of the most enjoyable moments.
It's not the shit. I saw a squirrel this past weekend and figured out that it stood under a bird feed thing that was stuck in a tree. Mm-hmm. It could just get free food because when the birds ate it, once every 2-3 minutes they would drop a grain accidentally. Mm-hmm. And there was this really fat squirrel who was just sitting there and spent the entire day mm-hmm. just sitting under a coop, you know. So I mean, like, it's so natural to just try to find exploits in everything.
Yeah.
And put your advantage.
There is a moral.
Even like, it doesn't work for immersion, but you still do it anyway.
There is a moral to that, though, is that for live action games, especially if you're playing with a live action game community, there is whatever you write down as a rule. You may put it up on a wall, you may put it in a piece of paper, someone's going to try to do it. And you have to think of, I'm going to put in a rule that's so ridiculous that that people are not going to want to try to do it because it's going to hurt them. Something like jump on the spot 100 times and you unlock this door, or you could find someone with lock picking, you know, and you would just assume that person's going to find someone with lock picking. No, someone's going to jump on the spot 100 times and they're going to hate you for it because you put the rule in there for it. So, you know, try not to hurt your players. Go be the moral, you know, because they will do what you tell them to do.
Is next time disclosure form?
All right, that's cards.
Before we go, I want to clarify in this version, the investigation mechanic. So the group of scientists gets to test two people. If you catch the thing, then they're dead and out. If you catch them on the second time, this is what I've read. If you catch them on the second guess, you get another guess. I'm not sure if that means you can have infinite guesses or not, so that's something to play around.
If you test the wrong person who's not the thing, they don't die?
No.
So I test someone the first time to the thing, then they're out. But I test someone a second time,
yeah.
Regardless of whether or not I tested a thing the first time.
Yes.
So you always get two tests.
At least two guesses.
But if you test someone on the second one, they don't die.
If they're the thing, they're dead.
Yeah,
the
thing dies. But if you test someone on the first time and they're the thing, you don't get an extra guess?
Well, not necessarily.
No, you get two.
You always get two.
Always get two. At least two.
So you have, if you guess any time.
But I'm saying if you get a
thing
and then not a
person, a knife.
Yeah.
But if you guess a thing and then not a thing, you get a third.
Yeah, I feel like you can catch the thing really.
Yeah, I think you can catch the thing without actually doing anything, like making a system where you automatically catch the thing. And you're getting two guesses, so the ratio of like. By randomly guessing,
well,
you'll certainly
change it, right? I mean, this is just what I found, and it seemed like an interesting way.
Yeah,
like, it's part of the point.
Which
phase do you start with?
No, you're not perfectly
resolved
because you could then.
As I recall, you would affect someone
right.
First.
Okay.
So you're going to have two on the first round anyway.
And, you know, this
or
is game like class. So
this seems really like.
Play around with the
like, bias towards the non-affected.
Well, let's find out.